Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation of Isaiah the 12th Hour in the Elvin, Texas. Today is September the 30th, it'll be 25. It is the 10th day of Tishri 2029. Today is the Day of Atonement. Our sermon for this hour is entitled, The Creation, Chapter 2, Patriarchs and Prophets, Ellen G. White. This chapter is based on Genesis 1 and 2. By the word of the Yahweh were the heavens made, and all the hosts of them by the breath of his mouth. For he spake, and it was, he commanded, and it stood fast. Psalms 33:6-9. He laid the foundations of the earth, that it should not be removed forever. Psalms 104:5. As the earth came forth from the hand of the Maker, it was exceedingly beautiful. Its surface was diversified with the mountains, hills, and plains, interspersed with the noble rivers and lovely lakes, but the hills and mountains were not abrupt and rugged, abounding in the terrible steeps and frightful chasms, as they now do, for the sharp, ragged edges of earth's rocky framework were buried beneath the fruitful soil, which everywhere produced a luxuriant growth of verdure. There was no loathsome swamps or barren deserts. Graceful shrubs and delicate flowers greeted the eye at every turn. The heights were crowned with trees more majestic than any that now exists. The air, untainted by the foul miasma, was clear and beautiful. The entire landscape outweighed in beauty the decorated grounds of the proudest palace, for the angelic host viewed the scene with the delight and rejoice at the wonderful works of the Yahweh. At the earth with its teeming animal and vegetable life had been called into existence, man as a crowning work of the creation and the one for whom the beautiful earth had been fitted up, was brought upon the stage of the action, and to him was given dominion over all that his eye could behold. For Yahweh said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over all the earth. So Yahweh created man in his own image. Male and female created he them. Here is clearly set forth the origin of the human race, and the divine record is so plainly stated that there is no occasion for the erroneous conclusion. For Yahweh created man in his own image. Here is no mystery. There is no ground for the supposition that man was evolved by the slow degrees of the development and the lower forms of the animal or vegetable life. Such teaching lowers the great work of the Creator unto the level of man's narrow earthly conception. Men are so intent upon excluding Yahweh from the sovereignty of the universe that they degrade man and defraud him of the dignity of his origin. He who sits the starry worlds on high and tended with the delicate skill the flowers of the field, who fill the earth and the heavens with the wonders of his power when he came to crown his glorious work, to place one in the midst to stand as the ruler of the fair earth, did not fail to create a being worthy of the hand that gave him life. For the genealogy of our race, as given by the inspiration, traces back its origin not to a line of the developing germs, molochs, and quadrupeds, but to the great creator. Though formed from the dust, Adam was the son of the Yahweh, for he was placed as Yahweh's representative over the lower order of the being. They cannot understand or acknowledge the sovereignty of Yahweh, yet they were made capable of loving and serving man. The psalmist said, Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hand. Thou hast put all things under his feet, the beast of the field, the fowl of the air, and whatsoever passes through the paths of the sea. Psalms 8:6-8. Man was to bear Yahweh's image, both in the outward resemblance and in the character, that sure alone is the express image, Hebrews 1:3, of the Father. But man was formed in the likeness of Yahweh. His nature was in the harmony with the will of Yahweh. His mind was capable of comprehending divine things. His affections were pure. His appetites and passions were under the control of the reason. He was only unhappy in bearing the image of the Father Yahweh and in the perfect obedience unto his will. As man came forth from the hand of his Creator, he was of a lofty stature and perfect symmetry. His countenance bore the ruddy tint of health and glowed with the light of life and joy. Adam's height was much greater than that of man who now inhabits the earth. Eve was somewhat less in stature, yet her form was noble and full of beauty. A sinless pair wore no artificial garments. They were clothed with a covering of light and glory, such as the angels wear. So long as they lived in obedience unto Yahweh, this robe of light continued to enshroud them. After the creation of Adam, every living creature was brought before him to receive his name. He saw that to each had been given a compassion, but among them there was not found an helpmate for him. Among all the creatures that Yahweh had made on the earth, there was not one equal to man. And Yahweh said, It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him an helpmate for him. Man was not made to dwell in solitude. He was to be a social being without companionship. The beautiful scenes and delightful employments of Eden would have failed to yield perfect happiness. Even communion with angels could not have satisfied his desire for sympathy and companionship. There was none of the same nature to love and to be loved. Yahweh himself gave Adam a companion. He provided an helpmate for him, a helper corresponding to him, one who was fitted to be his companion and who could be one with him in love and sympathy. He was created from a rib taken from the side of Adam, signifying that she was not to be to control him as the head, nor to be trampled under his feet as an inferior, but to stand by his side as an equal, to be loved and protected by him, a part of man, bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. She was his second self, showing the close union and the affectionate attachment that should exist in their relation. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourished and cherished it. Ephesians 5:29. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one. I always celebrate the first marriage. Thus the institution has for its originator the creator of the universe. Marriage is honorable. Hebrews 13:4. It is one of the first gifts of Yahweh to man, and it is one of the two institutions that after fall Adam brought with him beyond the gates of paradise, when the divine principles are recognized and obeyed in this relation. Marriage is a blessing. It guards the purity and happiness of the race. It provides for a man's social needs. It elevates the physical, the intellectual, and the moral nature. And Yahweh planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. Everything that Yahweh had made was a perfection of beauty, and nothing seemed wanting that could contribute to the happiness of the holy pair. Yet the Creator gave them still another token of his love by the preparing of a garden especially for their home. In this garden were the trees of every variety, many of them laden with the fragrant and delicious fruit. There were lovely vines, growing upright, yet presenting a most graceful appearance, with their branches drooping under their load of the tempting fruit of the richest and most varied hue. It was a work of Adam and Eve to train the branches of the vine to form bowers, thus making for themselves a dwelling from the living trees covered with foliage and fruit. There were fragrant flowers of every hue and a rich profusion. In the midst of the garden stood the tree of life, surpassing in glory all the other trees. Its fruit appeared like the apples of gold and silver, and had the power to perpetuate life. For the creation was now complete. The heavens and the earth were finished, and all the hosts of them. And Yahweh saw everything that it had made, and beheld it was very good. Eden blossomed on earth. Adam and Eve had free access to the tree of life. No taint of sin or shadow of death marred the fair creation. The morning stars sang together, and all the sons of Yahweh shouted for joy. Job 38:7. For the great Yahweh had laid the foundations of the earth. He had dressed the whole world in the garb of beauty, and had filled it with things useful to man. He had created all the wonders of the land and of the sea. In 6 days, the great work of the creation had been accomplished, and Yahweh rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. And Yahweh blessed the seventh day and sanctified it because that in it he had rested from all his work, which Yahweh created and made. Yahweh looked with the satisfaction upon the work of his hand. All was perfect, worthy of its divine author. And he rested not as one weary, but as well pleased with the fruits of his wisdom and goodness and the manifestations of his glory. After resting upon the seventh day, Yahweh sanctified it, or set it apart as a day of rest for man. Following the example of the Creator, man was to rest on the sacred day, that as he should look up on the heavens and the earth, he might reflect upon Yahweh's great work of the creation, and that as he should behold the evidence of Yahweh's wisdom and goodness, his heart might be filled with love and reverence for his Maker. In Eden, Yahweh set up the memorial of his work of creation. In placing his blessing upon the seventh day, the Sabbath was committed unto Adam, the father and representative of the whole human family. Its observance was to be an act of grateful acknowledgement on the part of all who should dwell upon the earth that Yahweh was their creator and their rightful sovereign, that they were the work of his hands and the subjects of his authority. Thus the institutions were wholly commemorated and given unto all mankind. There was nothing in it shadowy or of the restricted application unto any people. Yahweh saw that a Sabbath was essential for man, even in paradise. He needed to lay aside his own interest and pursuit for one day of the seventh. Then he might more fully contemplate the works of Yahweh and meditate upon his power and goodness. He needed a Sabbath to remind him more vividly of Yahweh and to awaken gratitude because all that he enjoyed and possessed came from the beneficent hand of the Creator. Yahweh designed that the Sabbath shall direct the minds of men to the contemplation of his created work. Nature speaks to their senses, declaring that there is a living Yahweh, the Creator, the supreme ruler of all. The heavens declare the glory of Yahweh, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. Psalms 19:1-2. For the beauty that clothes the earth is a token of Yahweh's love. We may behold it in the everlasting hills, in the lofty trees, in the opening buds, and the delicate flowers, all speak unto us of Yahweh. The Sabbath ever pointing to him who made them all, bids men open the great book of their nature and trace therein the wisdom, the power, and the love of the Creator. Our first parents, though created innocent and holy, were not placed beyond the possibility of wrongdoing. Yahweh made them free moral agents, capable of appreciating the wisdom and the benevolence of his character and the justice of his requirement, and with the full liberty to yield or to withhold obedience. They were to enjoy communion with the Yahweh and with the holy angels, but before they could be rendered eternally secure, their loyalty must be tested. At the very beginning of man's existence, a check was placed upon the desire for the self-indulgence, the fatal passion that lay at the foundation of the Satan's fall. The tree of the knowledge which stood near the tree of the life in the midst of the garden was to be a test of the obedience, faith, and love of our parents, while permitted to eat freely of every other tree, they were forbidden to taste of this on the pain of death. They were also to be exposed to the temptations of Satan, but if they endured the trial, they would finally be placed beyond his power to enjoy perpetual favor with the Yahweh. Yahweh placed man under and with a law as an indispensable condition of his very existence. He was a subject of the divine government, and there can be no government without law. Yahweh might have created man without the power to transgress his law. He might have withheld the hand of Adam from touching the forbidden fruit. But in that case, man would have been not a free moral agent, but a mere automation without the freedom of choice. His obedience would not have been voluntary but forced. There could have been no development of character. Such a course would have been contrary to Yahweh's plan in the dealing with the inhabitants of the other world. It would have been unworthy of man as an intelligent being, and would have sustained Satan's charge of Yahweh's arbitrary rule. Yahweh made man upright. He gave him noble traits of the character, with no bias toward evil. He endowed him with the high intellectual powers and presented before him the strongest possible inducement to be true to his allegiance. Obedience, perfect and perpetual, was a condition of the eternal happiness. On this condition, he was to have access to the tree of life. For the home of our first parents was to be a pattern for other homes as their children should go forth to occupy the earth. That home, beautified by the hand of Yahweh himself, was not a gorgeous palace. Men, in their pride, delight in magnificent and costly edifices, and glory in the works of their own hand. But Yahweh placed Adam in a garden. This was his dwelling. The blue heavens were his throne. The earth, with its delicate flowers and carpet of the living green, was his floor. And the leafy branches of the goodly tree were its canopy. Its walls were hung with the most magnificent adorning. The handiwork of the great master artist and the surroundings of the holy pair was a lesson for all time. That true happiness is found not in the indulgence of the pride and luxury, but in the communion with Yahweh through his created works. If man would give less attention to the artificial and would cultivate greater simplicity, they would come far nearer to answering the purpose of Yahweh and their creation. Pride and ambition are never satisfied, but those who are truly wise will find substantial and elevating pleasure in the sources of the enjoyment that Yahweh has placed within the reach of all. For the dwellers in Eden, unto the dwellers in Eden, was committed the care of the garden for the dressing of the garden and for the keeping of the garden. For their occupation was not wearisome, but pleasant and invigorating. Yahweh appointed labor as a blessing to man to occupy his mind, to strengthen his body, and to develop his faculty in the mental and physical activity. Adam found one of the highest pleasures of his holy existence. And when, as a result of his disobedience, he was driven from his beautiful home and forced to struggle with a stubborn soil to gain his daily bread, that very labor, although widely different from his pleasant occupation in the garden, was a safeguard against temptation and a source of happiness. Those who regard work as a curse are tended, though, it be with weariness and pain, or cherishing an error. For the rich often look down with a contempt upon the working classes, but this is wholly at the variance with Yahweh's purpose in the creating man. What are the possessions of even the most wealthy in comparison with the heritage given unto the lordly Adam? Yet Adam was not to be idle, for our Creator, who understand what is for the man's happiness, appointed Adam his work. The true joy of life is found only by the working men and women. The angels are diligent workers. They are the ministers of Yahweh unto the children of men. The Creator has prepared no place for the stagnating practice of the indolence. While they remained true to Yahweh, Adam and his companion were to bear rule over the earth. Unlimited control was given them over every living thing. The lion and the lamb sported peacefully around them, or lay down together at their feet. For the happy birds have flitted about them without fear, and as their glad songs ascended to the praise of their Creator, Adam and Eve united with them in the thanksgiving to the Father and the Son. For the holy pair were not only children under the fatherly care of Yahweh, but students receiving instruction from the all-wise Creator. They were visited by the angels and were granted communion with their Maker, with no obscuring veil between. They were full of the vigor imparted by the tree of life, and their intellectual power was but little less than that of the angels. For the mysteries of the visible universe, the wondrous works of Him which is purposed in knowledge, Job 37:16, afforded them an exhaustless source of the instruction and delight. The laws and operations of nature, which have engaged men's study for 6,000 years, were open unto their mind by the infinite framer and upholder of all. They held converse with the leaf and flower and tree, getting from each the secrets of its life. With every living creature and the mighty leviathan that plays among the waters, to the insect moat that floats in the sunbeam, Adam was familiar. He had given to each its name, and he was acquainted with the nature and habits of all. Yahweh's glory in the heavens the innumerable worlds and their orderly revolution, the balancing of the clouds, the mysteries of the light and sound of the day and night, all were open unto the study of our first parent. On every leaf of the forest or stone of the mountain, and every shining star in earth, air and sky, Yahweh's name was written. The order and harmony of the creation spoke to them of the infinite wisdom and power. They were ever discovering some attraction that filled their hearts with a deeper love and called forth fresh expressions of gratitude. So long as they remained loyal to the divine law, their capacity to know, to enjoy, and to love would continually increase, for they would be constantly gaining new treasures of knowledge, discovering fresh springs of happiness, and obtaining clearer and yet clearer conceptions of the immeasurable, unfailing love of Yahweh. Well, this brings the end of chapter 2. Chapter 3, this is the second half of our study for this hour, Patriarchs and Prophets, Ellen G. White. The title of this sermon is The Temptation and Fall. Okay, it's based on Genesis chapter 3. No longer free to stir up rebellion in heaven, Satan's enmity against Yahweh found a new field in the plotting the ruin of the human race. In the happiness and peace of the holy pair in Eden, he beheld a vision of the bliss that to him was forever lost. Moved by envy, he determined to incite them to disobedience and bring upon them the guilt and penalty of sin. He would change their love to distrust and their songs of praise to reproaches against their Maker. Thus he would not only plunge these innocent beings into the same misery which he was himself enduring, but would cast dishonor upon Yahweh and cause grief in heaven. Our first parents were not left without a warning of the danger that threatened them. Heavenly messengers opened unto them the history of Satan's power and his plots for their destruction, unfolding more fully the nature of the divine government which the prince of evil was trying to overthrow. It was by the disobedience to the just commands of Yahweh that Satan and his hosts had fallen. How important then that Adam and Eve should honor that law by which alone it was possible for order and equity to be maintained. The law of Yahweh is as sacred as Yahweh himself. It is a revelation of his will, a transcript of his character, for the expression of the divine, with the expression of the divine love and wisdom. For the harmony of the creation depends upon the perfect conformity of all beings, of everything, animate and inanimate, and to the law of the Creator. For the Yahweh has ordained laws for the government, not only of the living being, but of all the operations of nature. Every thing is under fixed law, which cannot be disregarded. While everything in nature is governed by the natural laws, man alone of all that inhabits the earth is amenable to the moral law. To man, as a crowning work of the creation, Yahweh has given power to understand his requirement, to comprehend the justice and beneficence of his love, and his sacred claims upon him, and of man unswerving obedience is required. Like the angels, the dwellers in Eden have been placed upon the probation, their happy estate could be retained only on the condition of fidelity to the Creator's law. They could obey and live, or disobey and perish. Yahweh had laid down the recipients of the rich blessing. But should they disregard his will, he who spared not the angels, the sin, could not spare them, for the transgression would forfeit his gifts and bring on them misery and ruin. For the angels warned them to be on their guard against the devices of Satan, for his efforts to ensnare them would be unwearied. While they were obedient to Yahweh, the evil one could not harm them, for if need be, every angel in heaven would be sent to their help. If they steadfastly repelled his first insinuations, they would be as secure as a heavenly messenger. But should they once yield to temptation, their name would become so depraved that in themselves they would have no power and no disposition to resist Satan. For the tree of knowledge has been made a test of their obedience and their love to Yahweh. For the Yahweh has seen fit to lay upon them the one prohibition as to the use of all that was in the garden. But if they should disregard his will in this particular, they would incur the guilt of the transgression. Satan was not to follow them with the continual temptation. He could have access to them only at the forbidden tree. Should they attempt to investigate its nature, they would be exposed to his wiles. They were admonished to give careful heed unto the warning which Yahweh had sent them, and to be content with the instruction which he has seen fit to impart. In order to accomplish his work unperceived, Satan chose to employ as his medium the serpent, a disguise well adopted for his purpose of deception. For the serpent was then one of the wisest and most beautiful creatures on the earth. It had wings, and while flying through the air, presented an appearance of the dazzling brightness, having the color and brilliancy of the burnished gold. Resting in the rich laden branches of the forbidden tree, and regaling itself with the delicious fruit, it was an odd object to arrest the attention and delight the eye of the beholder. Thus, in the Garden of Peace, lurked the destroyer, watching for his prey. For the angels had cautioned Eve to beware of separating herself from her husband, while occupied in their daily labor in the garden with him, she would be in less danger from temptation than if she were alone. But absorbed in her pleasing task, she unconsciously wandered from his side. On perceiving that she was alone, she felt an apprehension of danger, but dismissed her fears, deciding that she had sufficient wisdom and strength to discern evil and to withstand it. Unmindful of the angel's caution, she soon found herself gazing with mingled curiosity and admiration upon the forbidden tree, for the fruit was very beautiful, and she questioned with herself why Yahweh had withheld it from them. Now was the tempter's opportunity, as if he were able to discern the workings of her mind, he addressed her, "Yea, hath Yahweh said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden." He was surprised and startled as she thus seemed to hear the echo of her thoughts. But the serpent continued in a musical voice, with a subtle praise of her surpassing loveliness, and his words were not displeasing. Instead of fleeing from the spot, she lingered wonderingly to hear a serpent speak. Had she been addressed by a being like the angel, her fears would have been excited, but she had no thought that the fascinating serpent could become the medium of the fallen foe. To the tempter's ensnaring question, she replied, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, Yahweh has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die." And the serpent said unto the woman, "You shall not surely die, for Yahweh doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil." By the partaking of this tree, he declared, they would attain to a more exalted sphere of existence and enter a broader field of knowledge. For himself had eaten of the forbidden fruit, and as a result had acquired the power of speech. And he insinuated that the Yahweh jealously desired to withhold it from them, lest they should be exalted to equality with himself. It was because of its wonderful property, imparting wisdom and power, that he had prohibited them from tasting or even touching it. For the tempter intimated that the divine warning was not to be actually fulfilled. It was designed merely to intimidate them. How could it be possible for them to die? Had they not eaten of the tree of life, Yahweh had been seeking to prevent them from reaching a nobler development and finding greater happiness. Such has been Satan's work from the days of Adam until the present, and he has pursued it with a great success. For he tempts men to distrust Yahweh's love and to doubt his wisdom. He is constantly seeking to excite a spirit of irreverent curiosity, a restless inquisitive desire to penetrate the secrets of the divine wisdom and power, and their efforts to search out what Yahweh has been pleased to withhold, most cases overlooks the truth which he has revealed and which are essential to salvation. Satan tempts men to disobedience by the leading them to believe they are entering a wonderful field of the knowledge, but this is all a deception. Elated with their ideas of the progression, they are, by the trampling on the Yahweh's requirements, sitting their feet in the path that leads to degradation and death. Satan represented to the Holy Spirit that they would be gainers by breaking the law of Yahweh. Do we not today hear similar reasoning? Many talk of the narrowness of those who obey Yahweh's commandments, while they themselves claim to, let's read that again. Many talk of the narrowness of those who obey the Yahweh's commandments, while they themselves claim to have a broader idea and to enjoy greater liberty. What is this but an echo of the voice from the Eden? And the day ye eat thereof, transgress the divine requirement, you shall be as God. Satan claimed to have received great good by the eating of the forbidden fruit, but he did not let it appear that by the transgression he had become an outcast from heaven. Though he had found sin to result in the infinite loss, he concealed his own misery in order to draw others into the same position. So now, the transgressor seeks to disguise his true character. He may claim to be holy, but his exalted profession only makes him the more dangerous as a deceiver. He is on the side of Satan, trampling upon the law of Yahweh and leading others to do the same, to their eternal ruin. Eve really believed the words of Satan, but her belief did not save her from the penalty of sin. She disbelieved the words of Yahweh, and this is what led to her fall. In the judgment, men will not be condemned because they conscientiously believed a lie, but because they did not believe the truth, because they neglected the opportunity of the learning what is the truth. Notwithstanding the sophistry of Satan, to the contrary, it is always disastrous to disobey Yahweh. We must set our hearts to know what is and the truth. All the lessons which Yahweh has caused to be placed on record in His Word are for our warning and instruction. They are given to save us from deception. Their neglect will result in ruin to ourselves. Whatever contradicts Yahweh's Word, we may be sure proceeds from Satan. For the serpent took the fruit of the forbidden tree and placed it in the hands of the half-reluctant Eve. Then he reminded her of her own words, that Yahweh had forbidden them to touch it, lest they die. She would receive no more harm from eating the fruit, he declared, than from touching it, perceiving no evil results from what she had done. He grew bolder when she saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one right. She took of the fruit thereof and did eat. It was grateful to the taste. And as she ate, she seemed to feel a vivifying power and imagined herself entering upon a higher state. of your existence. Without a fear, she spoke to me, and now having herself transgressed, she became the agent of Satan and the working, the ruin of her husband. In a state of the strange, unnatural excitement, with her hands filled with the forbidden fruit, she sought his presence and related all that had occurred. An expression of the sadness came over the face of Adam. He appeared astonished and alarmed. To the words of Eve, he replied that this must be the foe against whom they had been born, and by the divine sentence she must die. In answer, she urged him to eat, repeating the words of the serpent, that they should not surely die. She reasoned that this must be true, for she felt no evidence of Yahweh's displeasure, but on the contrary realized a delicious, exhilarating influence filling every faculty with a new life, such she imagined, as inspired the heavenly messengers. Adam understood that his companion had transgressed the command of Yahweh, disregarded the only prohibition laid upon them as a test of their fidelity and love. There was a terrible struggle in his mind. He mourned that he had committed Eve to wander from his side, and now that Eve was done, he must be separated from her whose society had been his joy. How could he have it just? Adam had enjoyed the companionship of Yahweh and of the holy angel. He had looked upon the glory of the Creator. He understood the high destiny open to the human race could they remain faithful to Yahweh. Yet all these blessings were lost sight of in the fear of losing that one gift which in his eyes outvalued every other. Love, gratitude, loyalty to the Creator, all were overborne by the love to Eve. She was a part of himself, and he could not endure the thoughts of the separation. He did not realize that the same infinite power who had from the dust of the earth created him a living, beautiful form, and had in love given him a companion, could supply her place. He resolved to share her fate. If she must die, he would die with her. After all, he reasoned, might not the words of the wise serpent be true? He was before him, as beautiful and apparently as innocent as before this act of disobedience. She expressed greater love for him than before. No sign of the death appeared in her, and he decided to brave the consequences. He seized the fruit and quickly ate. After his transgression, Adam at first imagined himself entering upon a higher state of the existence, but soon the thought of his sin filled him with a terror. The air, which had hitherto been of a mild and uniform temperature, seemed to chill their guilty pair. The love and peace which had been theirs was gone, and in its place they felt a sense of sin, a dread of the future, a nakedness of the soul. For the robe of the light which had enshrouded them now disappeared, and to supply its place, they endeavored to fashion for themselves a covering, for they could not, while unclothed, meet the eye of Yahweh and holy angel. They now began to see the true character of their sin. Adam reproached his companion for her folly and leaving his side, and permitting himself to be deceived by the serpent, but they both flattered themselves that he who had given them so many evidences of his love would pardon this one transgression, or that they would not be subjected to so dire a punishment as they had feared. Satan exulted in his success. He had tempted the woman to distrust Yahweh's love, to doubt his wisdom, and to transgress his law. And through her, he had caused the overthrow of Adam. But the great lawgiver was about to make known unto Adam and Eve the consequences of their transgression. For the divine presence was manifested in the garden. In their innocence and holiness, they had joyfully welcomed the approach of their Creator. But now, they fled in terror and sought to hide in the deepest recesses of the garden. But the Yahweh called unto Adam and said unto him, Where art thou? And he said, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself. And he said, Who? I told thee that thou wast naked. Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat? Adam could neither deny or excuse his sin, but instead of the manifesting penitence, he endeavored to cast the blame upon his wife, and thus upon Yahweh himself. The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat. He who from love to Eve had deliberately chosen to forfeit the approval of Yahweh, his home in paradise, and an eternal life of joy, could now, after his fall, endeavor to make his companion and even the Creator himself responsible for the transgression. So terrible is the power of sin. When the woman was asked, What is this that thou hast done? She answered, The serpent beguiled me, and I did eat. Why didst thou create the serpent? Why didst thou suffer him to enter Eden? There were the questions implied in her excuse for her sin. Thus, like Adam, she charged Yahweh with the responsibility of their fall. The spirit of the self-justification originated in the Father of Lies. It was indulged by our first parents as soon as they yielded unto the influence of Satan, and has been exhibited by all the sons and daughters of Adam. Instead of the humbly confessing their sin, they try to shield themselves by the casting the blame upon others, upon the circumstances, or upon Yahweh, making even his blessing an occasion of the murmuring against him. For Yahweh then passed sentence upon the serpent, Because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle and above every beast of the field. Upon thy belly shalt thou go, and thus shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. Since it has been employed as Satan's medium, the serpent was assured the visitation of the divine judgment, and the most beautiful and admired of the creatures of the field, it was to become the most groveling and detested of them all. Feared and hated by both man and beast, the words next addressed to the serpent applied directly to Satan himself, pointing forward unto his ultimate defeat and destruction. I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. He shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. He was told of the sorrow and pain that must henceforth be her portion. And the Yahweh said, Thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. And the creation of Yahweh had made her the equal of Adam. Had they remained obedient to Yahweh in harmony with His with His great law of love, they would ever have been in harmony with each other. But sin had brought discord, and now their union should be maintained in harmony, preserved only by the submission on the part of the one or the other. Eve had been the first in the transgression, and she had fallen into the temptation by the separating from her companion, contrary to the divine direction. It was by her solicitation that Adam sinned, and she was now placed in subjection unto her husband. Had the principles enjoined in the law of Yahweh been cherished by the fallen race, this sentence, though growing out of the results of sin, would have proved a blessing unto them. But man's abuse of the supremacy thus given him has too often rendered the lot of woman very bitter and made her life a burden. Eve had been perfectly happy by her husband's side in her Eden home. But like restless modern Eve, she was flattered with the hope of entering a higher sphere than that which Yahweh had assigned her. In the attempting to rise above her original position, she fell far below it. A similar result will be reached by all who are unwilling to take up cheerfully their life duties in accordance with the Yahweh's plan. In their efforts to reach positions for which He has not fitted them, many are leaving vacant the place where they might be a blessing. In their desire for a higher sphere, many have sacrificed true womanly dignity and nobility of the character, and have left undone the very work that heaven appointed them. Unto Adam the Yahweh declared, "Because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, Thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake, and sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth unto thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field, and the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken. For thus thou art, and unto thus shalt thou return." It was not the will of Yahweh that the sinless parish should know aught of evil. He had freely given them the good, and had withheld evil, but contrary to His command, they had eaten of the forbidden tree, and now they would continue to eat of it. They would have the knowledge of evil all the days of their life. From that time, the race would be afflicted by Satan's temptation, instead of the happy labor hitherto appointed them. Anxiety and toil were to be their lot. They would be subject to the disappointment, grief, and pain, and finally to death. Under the curse of sin, all nature was to witness to man of the character and results of the rebellion against Yahweh. When Yahweh made man, He made him rule over the earth. And all living creatures, so long as Adam remained loyal to heaven, all nature was in subjection unto him. But when he rebelled against the divine law, the inferior creatures were in rebellion against his rule. Thus Yahweh, in his great mercy, would show men the sacredness of his law and lead them by their own experience to see the danger of sitting at his side even in the slightest degree, and the life of toil and care, which was henceforth to be man's allot, was appointed in love. It was a discipline rendered needful by his sin to place a check upon the indulgence of the appetite and passion, to develop habits of the self-control. It was a part of Yahweh's great plan of the man's recovery from the ruin and degradation of sin. A warning given to our first parents, and the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. Genesis 2:17. Did not imply that they were to die on the very day when they partake of the forbidden fruit, but on that day the irrevocable sentence would be pronounced. Immortality was promised them on condition of obedience. By the transgression they would forfeit eternal life. That very day they would be doomed to death. In order to possess an endless existence, man must continue to partake of the tree of life. Deprived of this, his vitality would gradually diminish until life should become extinct. It was Satan's plan that Adam and Eve should by the disobedience incur Yahweh's displeasure, and then, if they failed to obtain forgiveness, he hoped that they would eat of the tree of life, and thus perpetuate an existence of sin and misery. But after man's fall, holy angels were immediately commissioned to guard the tree of life. Around these angels flashed beams of the light, having the appearance of a glittering sword. None of the family of Adam were permitted to pass the barrier to partake of the life-giving fruit. Hence there is not an immortal sinner, for the tide of woe that flowed from the transgression of our first parents is regarded by many as too awful a consequence for so small a sin, and they impeach the wisdom and justice of Yahweh and his dealings with man. But if they would look more deeply into this question, they might discern their error. Yahweh created man after his own likeness, free from sin. The earth was to be peopled with beings only a little lower than the angels. But their obedience must be tested, for Yahweh would not permit the world to be filled with those who would disregard his law. Yet in his great mercy, he appointed Adam no severe test, and the very lightness of the prohibition made the sin exceedingly great. If Adam could not bear the smallest of the test, he could not have endured a greater trial had he been entrusted with the higher responsibility. Had some great test been appointed Adam, then those whose hearts inclined to evil would have excused themselves by saying, "This is a trivial matter, and Yahweh is not so particular about the little things," and there would be continual transgression in things looked upon as small and which pass unrebuked among men. But the Yahweh has made it evident that sin in any degree is offensive unto him. The Eve has seen a small thing to disobey Yahweh by the tasting the fruit of the forbidden tree, and attempt her husband also to transgress. But their sin opened the floodgates of woe upon the world. Who can know in a moment of temptation the terrible consequences that will result from one wrong step? Many who teach that the law of Yahweh is not binding upon man urge that it is impossible for him to obey the precepts. But if this were true, why did Adam suffer the penalty of transgression? For the sin of our first parents brought guilt and sorrow upon the world. And had it not been for the goodness and mercy of Yahweh, would have plunged the race into hopeless despair, that none deceive themselves, for the wages of sin is death. Romans 6:23. For the law of Yahweh can no more be transgressed than offended. Now then, when sin was pronounced upon the father of mankind, after this sin, Adam and Eve were no longer to dwell in Eden. They earnestly entreated that they might remain in the home of their innocence and joy. They confessed that they had forfeited all right to that happy abode, but pledged themselves to the future to yield strict obedience unto Yahweh. But they were told that their nature had become depraved by sin, they had lessened their strength to resist evil, and had opened a way to Satan to gain more ready access to them and their innocence. They had yielded to temptation, and now in a state of their conscious guilt, they would have less power to maintain their integrity. In the humility and unutterable sadness, they bade farewell to their beautiful home, and went forth to dwell upon the earth, where rested the curse of sin. For the atmosphere, once so mild and uniform in temperature, was now subject to marked changes, and the Yahweh mercifully provided them with a garment of skin as a protection from the extreme of heat and cold. As they witnessed in the drooping flowers and the failing on the fallen leaf the first signs of decay, Adam and his companions mourned more deeply. Adam and his companion Eve mourned more deeply than men now mourn over their dead, for the death of the frail, delicate flower was indeed a cause of sorrow. But when the deadly trees had cast off their leaves, the scene brought vividly to mind the stern fact that death is a portion of every living thing. For the Garden of Eden remained upon the earth long after man had become an outcast from his pleasant path. For the fallen race were long permitted to gaze upon the home of the innocent, their entrance barred only by the watching angel at the cherubim guarded gate of paradise. The divine glory was revealed. Hither came Adam and his sons. Let's read that again. For hither came the Adam and his sons to worship Yahweh. Here they renewed their vows of the obedience unto the law, that the transgression of which had banished them from Eden. When the tide of iniquity overspread the world, and the wickedness of men determined their destruction by a flood of waters, the hand that had planted Eden withdrew it from the earth. But in the final restitution, when there shall be a new heaven and a new earth, Revelation 21:1, it is to be restored more gloriously adorned than at the beginning. And they that have kept Yahweh's commandments shall breathe in the immortal vigor beneath the tree of life, and through the unending ages, the inhabitants of the sinless world shall behold in that garden of the delight a sample of the perfect work of Yahweh's creation, untouched by the curse of sin, a sample of what the whole earth would have become had man but fulfilled the Creator's glorious plan. This brings us to the end of chapter 3. We will now close with this song.